Four Meals from Anarchy by Duncan Robb. Prologue. The cable writhed and twisted like an evil serpent in its death throes. The inner metal wires curled in on each other, and different materials expanded and contracted at different rates, the copper pushing out, the zinc alloy pulling in. Some elements fused together, others pushed apart. Sparks jumped between the strands of wire, the heat grew intense. The metal braiding glowed red-hot and the outer PVC casing slowly melted, dissolving into a muddy liquid and evaporating as an acrid black smoke. Viktor Volkov and Dmitry Egorchev watched in ghoulish fascination from behind the half-inch-thick glass screen. They couldn't smell the smoke or hear the wires popping as the heat eventually caused them to crumble. All they could do was watch. For 5 minutes, they said nothing, eyes wide, mouths gaping as the scene played out. From the moment Viktor pressed the activation button to the last whisper of smoke being sucked out by the extractor fan, it had only taken 300 seconds for 6 feet of data cable to be reduced to a black stain on the white resin floor of the chamber. After months of experiments, after trying hundreds of radical algorithms, after one failure following another, it had worked. They had developed a virus that would hide inside software until activated, then physically destroy the cables connecting computers, processors, or whatever they targeted. They turned to each other and high-fived, grinning like a pair of naughty schoolboys. They were a little older than schoolboys, Viktor 29, Dmitry 28, but they behaved as if they were 10 years younger. They'd been hacking into computer systems for over 10 years and creating viruses for most of that time, viruses that had already caused damage conservatively estimated in the tens of millions of US dollars. Their notoriety had brought them to the attention, firstly of organized crime leaders, then the SVR, who discovered them while breaking up the gang the two geeks had found themselves working for. Initially, the SVR dismissed Viktor and Dmitry as a couple of computer nerds, clever but ultimately harmless. It was only when the intelligence agency delved deeper into the activities of the two young men that their true genius was realized, and they were put to work on behalf of the state. To Mechislav Medvedev, the head of the computer infiltration program, they were his prized possession, and he guarded them jealously. He handled them like a protective uncle, giving them anything they wanted, denying them nothing and attending to their every need. Not that they required much, neither drank, smoked, or took drugs, they ate little and showed no enthusiasm for the women he supplied. He arranged adjoining apartments for them in a brand new luxury development in the Arbat district, a popular area for government employees. They were chauffeured to the office every day as neither of them drove, and they rarely went out. They had little contact with their families, it was their choice, and they were content, or even thrilled, to spend long days in front of a computer screen or experimenting with specialist equipment, experimental systems, and sophisticated instruments. Medvedev was astonished at the speed they acquired new skills. The office he assigned to them was more like a laboratory, and provided they had a regular supply of fresh coffee, the two of them would work late into the night or the small hours of the next day, making few demands on him or his staff other than a hunger for new challenges or a fresh target. Their brief was simple: develop new ways to attack Western intelligence and create maximum infrastructure damage, with particular emphasis on computer systems and commercial operations. Dmitry was the first to identify the possibility of creating a computer virus that could do physical damage. Along with Viktor, he had devoted his efforts to software programs that could be delivered by email to personal computers or direct injection into servers. They had proved highly effective and caused considerable embarrassment to government departments, utility companies, and multinational companies. But Dmitry wanted more. Their victims were fighting back, security systems were more and more difficult to infiltrate, and to make matters worse, they were starting to trace the source of the viruses back to Russia. What really concentrated Dmitry's mind was the fact that however much damage he did, however much data his victims lost, they had developed backup systems and could restore the software within a few days. Reputations might suffer, and the Western press loved to highlight the failings of big business to protect the data it held, but ultimately, everything was back to normal after a week. Dmitry wanted more, he wanted to create lasting damage. He and Viktor had been the outstanding students in their class, leagues ahead of the others, they'd seen the disruption that a virus could do and got a vicarious satisfaction from seeing the headlines. It frustrated Dmitry that it was short-lived, and he knew he could do better. The pair recognized the weakness in most viruses. They relied on their victims to take some sort of action for the damage to be done. They needed to find a way to target specific devices at a time of their choosing and then deliver their virus, surgically inject it, in such a way that their victim would know nothing about it until it was activated. A sleeping bug, awaiting the command of its master. It was Victor who came up with a name for it. It had to have a memorable name, and seeing it come back to life after lying dormant for a 6-month trial, he called it Aurora, the Sleeping Beauty. If the name was good enough for Tchaikovsky, it was good enough for him. He conveniently ignored the connection to Disney. They watched a moment longer as the chamber cleared, 3 feet long, 18 inches high and 12 inches deep. It had an hermetically sealed lid with a single outlet at the back connected to a 4-inch-wide flexible rubber pipe that sucked the poisonous fumes through a series of filters, before venting them to the outside world. Victor released the catches on the lid, opening it cautiously before prodding the remains of the cable with a steel ruler. "We need to call Dracula and let him see this." Dimitri was still grinning at the effects of the virus. It might even put a smile on his face. Medvedev rarely smiled, his dour demeanor and dark features made the nickname the two referred to him by almost inevitable. Victor made the call and 10 minutes later Medvedev appeared in the doorway of the office, having crossed the courtyard from the admin building to their office. He shook the water off a lightweight raincoat and the two computer gurus realized from his appearance it must be raining outside. He threw the coat over the back of a chair and negotiated his way through the discarded boxes, spare chairs, desks, and abandoned equipment to where they sat on stools. "The message said you had something to show me." He didn't make eye contact but stared at the empty chamber, brows furrowed. "This had better be good."
"This is better than good,"
Dimitri responded.
"We think you're going to like this,"
Victor added. Medvedev looked at each of them in turn, then back at the chamber. "All I see is a pile of black dust. Am I missing something?" Dimitri held up a hand.
"We wanted you to see it from the start."
He nodded to Victor, who opened the lid of the chamber and dropped in another length of data cable, 6 feet of it tightly coiled and secured with a plastic clip. One end of the cable was plugged into the side of a smooth black box, a little smaller than a pack of cigarettes. Victor closed the lid and fastened the catches to seal it tight. Medvedev said nothing, his curiosity piqued, and he stood between Dimitri and Victor, arms folded, watching intently. Victor reached to his right and retrieved a matching black box with a couple of buttons on it, one above the other, and two small LED lights, side by side at the top. Without a word, he held it up to show Medvedev, like a magician trying to convince his audience he had nothing up his sleeve. Dimitri nodded, giving Victor the go-ahead. Victor pressed the uppermost button on the box, and the LED on the left lit up green. He waited a couple of seconds, glancing briefly at Medvedev to make sure his boss was watching. The LED turned red, and Victor pressed the lower of the two buttons. The second LED illuminated two red lights. Medvedev's eyes narrowed as he stared at the cable. Nothing happened. He angled his head and turned to Victor. He didn't have to speak, the look said everything.
"Keep watching."
Victor was untroubled by the look. There was no noise, the chamber was soundproof. There was no smell, the seal was airtight. It was brightly lit, and Medvedev could see clearly, but nothing moved. He inched closer to the chamber and bent forward, his eyes inches from the glass. He thought he saw something. The smallest vibration, as if the cable shuddered. He glanced quickly at his two protégés, the faintest smile played on their faces. Dimitri almost whispered.
"This is the best bit, watch closely."
Medvedev was mesmerized, transfixed by the movements of the cable in the chamber. The coils had started to tighten on themselves as if shrinking. The vibration continued, still barely perceptible but constant. The dark blue PVC outer cable appeared to soften and gave off faint wisps of gray smoke. Suddenly the cable jerked as if in spasm, it took on a life of its own. The coils were wrapped so tight that the cable looked like a rough dark blue ball. The wisps of smoke turned black, more intense, more malevolent. As with the previous test, the cable went into its death throes, crumbling to dust,
the PVC outer melting away like an ice cube in a red-hot frying pan. Medvedev stood back, unable to take his gaze from the chamber. "Good God, boys." He closed his eyes and shook his head, trying to bring himself back to reality. "You've done it." Dmitry winked at Viktor, who watched Medvedev's reaction with satisfaction. The two of them bumped fists behind their boss's back. They contained their enthusiasm, putting on a show of restrained cool, acting as if they'd done nothing more than learn how to boil the kettle. Medvedev turned to Dmitry. "So, are you going to tell me how you made it work?" Dmitry opened his mouth, about to answer when Viktor butted in. "It's all done with ultra-high frequency vibration." He paused for breath, giving Dmitry an opening. "We played around with electromagnetic pulses. One on its own had no effect, but when we charged it with two at the same time, we set up a resonance, a vibration." Viktor continued. "The complicated bit was getting the pulses to peak at alternate times. If both peaked at the same time, it just vibrated, nothing more. But once we set it up so their wave patterns were opposed to each other, it started to generate heat." Dmitry cut across again. "After that, it was just a case of playing with the frequency bands to find the optimum level where the cable became so hot it melted." Medvedev was tired of looking left and right as they each spoke. He stood back to get them both in view at the same time. He wasn't sure he fully understood what they had just told him, but he was never going to admit it. His arms were folded across his chest, and he reached up with his left hand and stroked his short black beard thoughtfully. He studied them both without saying a word, eyes narrowed, lips pursed. What they had created could wreak so much damage it almost frightened him. Almost, but not enough for him not to immediately consider how he could use it. Medvedev addressed his next question at a point halfway between Dmitry and Viktor, his eyes focused on the glass chamber. "As a virus, it is unique, it has great potential. But," he paused and looked at them, one at a time. "But the question is, how do we deliver it? How do we get it into the cabling and networks of an organization we may wish to," he gestured, hands flapping as if in search of the right word. "Compromise?" Dmitry nodded. He gave Viktor a look that said, "I'll handle this." Viktor kept quiet. "That was the most difficult bit, and that's what we've been working on for most of the last 2 months. Please tell me you've come up with a solution. You've got people on the inside, haven't you?" Medvedev squinted at Dmitry. "That sort of information is classified." "Well, let's assume you've got someone on the inside, just for argument's sake." He got no further comment from his boss, so he continued. "At first, we scaled down the trigger mechanism." He nodded to the small black box that Viktor had used to activate the virus. "That was our original, we just use it for convenience. We created a version about this big." He held up his right hand, thumb and forefinger about an inch apart to demonstrate. "The plan was to clip it over a wire or a cable. It would be programmed to activate at a given time." Medvedev scratched his temples. "Hold on, so you're saying that you plan to physically put something in place?" Viktor couldn't resist taking over again. "The trouble with every other virus is that it depends on the host clicking on something, usually a link in an email. They have to take some sort of action, open a file or activate a line of code." He paused while Medvedev listened to the obvious fact and tipped his chin, eyes locked on Viktor, waiting for more. "You don't need me to tell you that people are a little less gullible than they used to be. Virus protection systems are more robust and security protocols prevent links and attachments being delivered or opened." Medvedev appeared irritated by this. "Tell me something I don't know." Viktor ignored the question and continued. "We've always worked on the principle of infiltrating the computer software, and that's where organizations have beefed up their protection. We talked about this months ago. I want to know what you've come up with that's going to make a difference." Medvedev kept his voice low, but his tone expressed frustration. "We realized that we could do more damage by looking elsewhere, not so much at the organs of the body, but at the blood supply." Viktor thought the analogy was self-explanatory. Medvedev didn't want Viktor to think he didn't follow and turned to Dmitry for further explanation. "The computer systems process the data that's been transmitted to them, but the data, especially financial data, is transmitted down phone lines. Financial transactions are the lifeblood of civilization. He mocked the last word with air quotes. 9 out of 10 of those are made by card, and every one of those relies on phone lines. Medvedev's eyes widened. He could see where they were going. Dmitry went on. There are only around 20 card processing companies serving the UK. They have hubs and satellites, but essentially all card payments go through one of those organizations. So? Medvedev made hurry-up motions with his hands. So, we want to get into the phone lines of those companies. If we destroy those lines, Dmitry ran his finger across his throat. And can you? They both nodded. How? Victor explained. We send Aurora down the phone lines. We've built into the code an algorithm that attaches the virus to the power circuit of the host. The host has no way of knowing it's there. It's a bit like ringing a number and nobody answering. The signal gets to a certain point, but no further unless someone picks up the phone. As it's a data line, no one will pick it up. As long as the system is powered up, Aurora will sleep until we wake her up. Dmitry could see that Medvedev had identified a potential flaw and jumped in before he could speak. I know what you're going to say. How do we target them? The data lines don't have numbers. Medvedev nodded. They do, but they're not released, they're not publicly available. And that's why you want someone on the inside? The clouds parted and Medvedev understood Dmitry's earlier question. The numbers will appear on the paperwork from the phone companies. They won't be easy to get hold of, but if you've got an asset capable of infiltrating the phone companies, they could find them for us. We can take it from there. The beard received more stroking as Medvedev considered this. Have you investigated how many phone companies there are? Not really, it doesn't matter. I thought it would be vital to know. Why have you not done your research? We have, we lost count after 30, but like I said, it doesn't matter. Dmitry said. Medvedev paused. He didn't want to look stupid by missing the obvious answer. After a few seconds, he knew he couldn't maintain the pretense any longer. Okay, so tell me why not. All the phone lines are installed by the same company. The phone companies just pay to use them. All the lines, the exchanges, and the individual distribution cabinets are installed and maintained by a company called Connectivity. Victor smoothly took over. You only have to get someone into Connectivity, someone good, someone who can gain access to their internal security, and they'll be able to provide us with the line numbers that each of the card processing companies use. Once we've got those, we send Aurora, Indiana. Dmitry concluded with a flourish. Medvedev studied the two of them again. He didn't comment. He could see the simplicity of their plan and he liked simplicity. From his experience, the more complicated things became, the more likely it was to go wrong. And from his experience, when things went wrong at this level, people died. He didn't want to be one of those people. He folded his arms and walked slowly around the office, staring at the floor in front of him, deep in thought. Dmitry and Victor watched, they exchanged glances and shrugged, knowing it was best to say nothing. Medvedev completed a lap of the office and returned. He pulled up a chair and sat down. He leaned back, legs stretched out in front of him, arms still folded. He raised his eyes and stared at the empty glass chamber as if for reassurance. I wish it was that simple. He said eventually. We either have to try and get one of our people into this Connectivity company or turn someone who's already there, someone at a very senior level. He talked as if mulling the idea over in his mind. He wasn't looking at either Dmitry or Victor, just letting them know what he was thinking. Isn't that what you're good at? Said Victor. The faintest of smiles played on Medvedev's lips, a smile that spoke volumes, a smile that acknowledged Victor's remark but gave nothing away, a smile of inner confidence. Knowing it was something he was good at, something he'd done before. Could he do it again? Possibly. He replied. Dmitry wanted something a little more positive. We've worked non-stop for months on this, you told us to do our bit and leave the delivery up to you. Medvedev turned. You, his forefinger stabbed at Dmitry, his eyes boring into him. Do not tell me what to do. Victor came to the rescue. We wouldn't dream of telling you what to do, we just need to know what else we can do to help. Medvedev pushed the chair back and stood up. Right, I've seen enough. I'm going to arrange a team meeting, and we'll work something out. You two better make sure you're ready to go with this when I give you the word. 18 months later. Friday, December 22nd. When Christmas Day falls on a Monday, the previous Friday is chaotic, stressful, and rushed. The prospect of a four-day holiday induces a siege-like mentality. Supermarket shelves are stripped quicker than they can be restocked and overloaded trolleys queue at checkouts, while fractious kids test harassed parents to breaking point. Susie Jones suffered in silence. She tried to shut out the cacophony of noise and consulted her shopping list, checking off the items against the contents of her trolley. Having spent the last hour battling her way around the aisles, she had no wish to go shopping again for at least a week. She joined what she considered the shortest queue and waited patiently while the checkout operator, complete with fluffy reindeer horns and an expression that screamed, "How much longer?" swiped items past the barcode reader and the machine pinged in response. The customer in front of Susie started unloading their shopping onto the conveyor belt as the previous shopper's last item registered its details and the board operator looked up at the screen. "That's £117.02. "No please, no thank you," just a nod at the card reader. Susie paid little attention. She was distracted by the behavior of two children at the next checkout who appeared determined to drive their mother to an early grave with a constant stream of bickering, pushing, pinching, name-calling, and face-pulling. There were times when Susie wondered if she'd be a good mom. Right now she knew she wouldn't be. The customer in the queue ahead of Susie had piled their goods onto the stationary belt, waiting for it to start moving. There was a problem. "Your card's been declined." The checkout operator mumbled to the man who had just packed all his Christmas food and drink into bags on his trolley. "Have you got another one?" He stared at the monitor without making eye contact with the customer. The man retrieved his card from the reader and examined it, front and back, as if its appearance would explain why it hadn't worked. He wiped the back of the card against his sleeve and reinserted it. He shook his head, puzzled. "There's plenty of money in the account, don't know what the problem is." He tapped in his PIN with a little more care than normal. Susie watched with interest, trying to decide who was more frustrated, the checkout operator who didn't want to have to call his supervisor, or the customer who was becoming conscious of other shoppers getting impatient with him. She concluded the checkout operator didn't care much either way, but the shopper had started to look agitated and a little flushed as the second attempt failed. "Have you got another card?" The checkout operator, Susie saw from his badge that his name was Ollie, had made the supreme effort to look at the customer, assuming that everyone had more than one means of paying. "Hang on." The frustrated shopper fumbled in his wallet and produced another card which he swapped for the rejected one. "Not sure I can remember the PIN for this one." He tapped four digits on the keyboard, mentally crossing his fingers. No joy. Susie watched with increasing irritation. "Why did I choose this queue?" she asked herself. Her attention shifted to the next queue with the argumentative children. The same thing was happening. The card had been declined and another customer, an already overstressed mother, was frantically trying an alternative payment method. At the checkout behind her, Susie turned to see if the scene was being repeated elsewhere, but the shopper was peeling off a bundle of notes and handing over the cash. No problem there. Her gaze shifted to checkouts beyond and sure enough, a growing number of customers were struggling to find a card that would be accepted by the system. None worked, and the tension grew. The supervisor was a woman in her late 30s, with dark hair cropped short, a uniform that was a touch too small and a worried expression. Her badge, a smarter version than Ollie's, stated her name was Jeannie. She brushed Ollie aside, the message being that he was at fault, and took control of the terminal. She keyed in her admin code to override the automated systems and pressed the reset button to reboot the connection to the card processing company, but the screen went blank. She stabbed at the keys with increasing pressure, aware that a growing crowd of shoppers were watching, waiting for her to find the magic answer to the problem. Someone behind Susie called out. "Come on, sort it out, some of us have got better things to do." Susie turned to see who had spoken, a bald man about 6'2" and big with it some sort of Celtic symbol tattooed on his neck. He looked as if he enjoyed confrontation and was used to getting his own way. He had his arms folded and glared at Jeannie. His partner, a plump woman with bleached blonde hair and too much makeup, stood a foot shorter than him and slightly behind him. She looked embarrassed and dug him in the ribs. "Shoo, Bernie, they're doing their best." Bernie was having nothing of it and brushed off her concerns. "Bollocks, they're bloody clueless, they've crashed the system, it can't cope with the pressure." He looked around, relishing the attention. He nudged his overloaded shopping trolley, producing a lot of clinking noises. He addressed his next remark directly at Jeannie. "If your bloody card machine's packed in, then those of us paying cash should get priority." He waved a substantial roll of notes at the supervisor to make his point. Susie watched the reactions of those around her with interest. Human nature was fascinating in circumstances like this, and she noted looks of horror, expectation, and even mild amusement. Some agreed and felt the need to waive their supply of cash. Others looked crestfallen, obviously not in possession of enough of the folding stuff to meet the bill. Her observations were interrupted by her phone. She didn't hear it so much as feel it vibrating in the back pocket of her jeans. The original customer, the one whose card had broken the system in the eyes of those behind him, was standing beside his trolley, looking forlornly at all the Christmas food he'd painstakingly selected, faithfully following the list his wife had prepared. A bead of sweat slowly slipped down his forehead, which had reddened noticeably. Nobody was taking any notice of him. The red lights above each till, indicating that help was required, lit up at the other 25 checkouts. Jeannie was flustered, and tempers were frayed. She looked around for support, but there was none. All hands were on deck, every available member of staff who could operate one of the checkouts was doing so. She sent Ollie to find the store manager. The manager was in the warehouse attempting to manage the restocking of the shelves, a thankless task made more difficult by late deliveries and the fact that he had no spare staff. He had no idea of the chaos unfolding at the front of the store until Ollie pushed his way through the swing doors and called for him. "Mr. Waterford." The manager turned to see Ollie, standing by the doors looking lost and a little uncertain. "Jeannie sent me to ask you to come and help." Stuart Waterford gazed at the ceiling in exasperation. "Like I've got nothing else to do?" He held his arms out, palms up. "Why does she need me?" He had quite enough on his plate without having to drop what he was doing to help his checkout supervisor. He'd been store manager, a good one, for 3 years, his staff were well trained, he'd delegated well. Jeannie knew the checkouts better than anyone else. "What can I do to help? She's the expert." He glared at Ollie. Ollie wasn't expecting an interrogation and resented the assumption that he was somehow the cause of the problem. "There's something wrong with the tills and she can't fix it." With a resigned sigh, Waterford retrieved his jacket from the seat of a forklift truck, struggled into it and straightened his tie as he made his way through the doors. Ollie gave him a head start, he didn't want to have to talk to the manager, then followed at a distance back to the checkouts. Jeannie was waiting for Waterford with a group of irate customers clustered about her demanding answers. Several abandoned trolleys blocked aisles, the mood was hostile. She extracted herself and caught the manager by the arm, leading him away from the worst of the noise. Waterford was momentarily confused. "What the hell's going on, Jeannie?" "The data link's gone down, we can't process card payments." She watched her manager as he took in the chaotic scene, eyes widening as the full impact took hold. "Jesus bloody Christ." Waterford cursed. He turned to Jeannie. "I'm guessing you've done a full reboot?" "Twice," she nodded. "Nothing wrong with the system or the terminals." "We've got no connection, it's completely dead. Of all the times for it to crash, this is the worst possible." Waterford was trying to keep calm but failing. He didn't have to be a genius to see where this was going. He became conscious that he had become the center of attention, all eyes were on him. He was in charge and had to act. "Are we okay taking cash?" He turned to Jeannie, raising both eyebrows, hopeful. She nodded in response. "Yeah, cash is no problem, there's nothing wrong at our end." Waterford pursed his lips and studied the shoppers, most of whom were staring back at him. He made a decision, headed for Jeannie's desk, picked up the microphone used for store announcements and keyed the talk switch. "Ladies and gentlemen, you may have realized we have a problem at the moment, and I apologize for keeping you waiting at this busy time. I regret that due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to accept card payments at the moment. We are working hard to solve this problem and hope to rectify the situation very shortly. In the meantime, any customers who are in a position to pay with cash should make their way to checkouts 8, 9 and 10, where we will be happy to serve you." He turned to Jeannie, who was watching the reaction of the shoppers. "Get those three cleared of card customers and put your best operators on them. What are we going to tell all the people waiting?" There was a note of panic in her voice. "Tell them to give us 10 minutes. If they can't wait, there's nothing we can do." He felt as panic-stricken as she was but didn't want her to know. "I'm going to ring HQ and see if they've got any ideas." He was about to walk, or even run, back to his office, when Susie Jones caught up with him. It hadn't taken her long to realize that A, there was a problem and B, it was going to quickly escalate. She was never much of a spectator, and her inquisitive nature and professional interest got the better of her. When she spotted Waterford at the microphone, she had her target. She pushed her shopping out of the way and elbowed her way through the throng. "Excuse me, are you the manager?"
"I am, but I'm afraid I'm in a bit of a rush."
Waterford tried to shake her off, but Susie was persistent. "Just hang on a second, I think this a bigger problem than it appears." That stopped the manager in his tracks. He turned and appraised Susie. Her mousy brown hair had fallen forward like a fringe and her bright brown eyes drilled into him. She was dressed in jeans and a dark blue microfiber jacket that was zipped up to her neck. He was a few inches taller and looked down at her. "What are you talking about? It's not just your connection that's gone down." She'd overheard the conversation he'd had with Jeannie. "The cash machines outside are offline as well." Waterford absorbed this information for a second or two. "So, it must be some sort of local thing?" Susie shook her head. "I've just spoken to a friend in Oxford, the same things happened there." "Bloody hell." The color drained from his face. "What am I meant to do?" "If I was you, I'd get onto your head office, but you're going to have to be quick. Another 5 minutes, you'll have a riot in your hands." Susie had turned away from Waterford and watched angry shoppers jostling for position. Those with cash were already queuing at the three checkouts. They were in the minority, and most had adopted a resigned look, settling in for a long wait while somebody fixed the system. They were going to be sorely disappointed. When she turned back, Waterford had gone. She hoped he hadn't left the building but felt he must have been tempted. The checkout supervisor, Jeannie, had quickly organized what she could. The three cash tills were doing a brisk trade while the others stood idle. The other operators had left their stations rather than try and make small talk with frustrated customers. They gathered at the checkout furthest from the door. Safety in numbers. Susie watched and listened as she worked her way through the crowd, returning to her trolley as if it were some sort of refuge. She could feel the tension in the air, like a shaken bottle of fizz. It could pop at any moment. She pulled her phone out and called her husband. "Hello, love, you okay?" Nick sounded cheerful. Susie had to put her hand over one ear while she held the phone to the other one. The noise level was building steadily and she had trouble hearing what he was saying. It didn't help that Nick was speaking from a boisterous bar and the Christmas spirit was flowing freely. "Are you sober?"
"As a judge, my darling girl."
"I'm on the bike, haven't touched a drop." "Can you get outside or go somewhere quiet? That sounds like you've got something serious to say." The voice became clearer as Nick moved towards a quiet corner. "Possibly." Susie had to raise her voice to make herself heard above the cacophony. "How much money have you got on you?"
"Strange question."
Nick replied.
"You mean cash?"
"Yeah, cash, coins, real money." "Why on earth do you want to know that?"
"I've got a bad feeling, Nick."
Susie wanted Nick to hear her but not those around her. She talked in a raised whisper. "Something is happening that could be serious." Nick picked up on his wife's concern. He knew she wasn't one to react without good reason.
"Where are you?" he could the background noises around Susie.
I'm at Tesco's, the card machines have packed in, nobody can pay for their shopping. She said, trying to stick to the facts.
Have you tried the hole in the wall?
I haven't, but some other people have, and they say there's no joy there either.
Is it a local thing?
Don't think so. Anna called me a few minutes ago. She's in Oxford and the same thing's happening there.
Nick was silent for a moment, thinking.
That might explain why Tim's card was refused when he tried to buy a round 5 minutes ago. He thought it was funny but just paid with cash.
If this is happening all over the place, it could get very messy.
Nick grasped the situation quickly.
Messy?
If they don't sort it out quickly, there'll be a riot.
I'm going to have to ring the office.
Will there be anyone there?
Late Friday afternoon before Christmas, they'll all have gone home.
There'll be someone manning the switchboard, they can't all just pack in, 'cause it's Christmas.
Nick agreed.
Guess so, your gaffer sounds like the sort who's on call 24/7.
I'm just worried he'll call me in if he thinks it could escalate.
Nick had stepped outside. Susie was aware the background noise had receded, and she could hear the occasional car passing.
She could hear Nick clearly.
It's probably just a glitch, a power cut or something, the system might have just cried enough, can't cope with the pressure.
They'll be working flat out to get it up and running, they can't afford not to.
Think of the money they could be losing.
While Susie listened to Nick, she looked around the supermarket.
The three cash-only checkouts were busy, but not excessively so.
The other checkouts stood idle, operators talking to each other in a corner trying to avoid eye contact with disgruntled shoppers.
The shoppers were talking to each other, exchanging views, checking watches, making phone calls and in several cases, trying desperately to maintain control of young children who were growing increasingly bored.
She noticed a growing number of trolleys blocking aisles, where customers had given up waiting and simply walked out of the store, abandoning the essential supplies they'd battled with their fellow shoppers to pick up.
Nick was right, each trolley was fully loaded, and the cost of lost sales would be clocking up, thousands of pounds every minute.
She came to a decision.
Okay. Look, I'll call the office, at least I won't be accused of doing nothing.
She nodded to herself as if affirming it was the right thing to do.
In the meantime, don't spend any cash, whatever you've got might be all we have to live on.
Nick chuckled.
Well, that gets me out of buying the next round.
You can thank me later.
Susie replied.
I'll call you back when I've got some news from the office.
She ended the call, pushed her trolley even further away from the masses and went outside for better reception.
It was dusk and fog had descended, adding to the cold and damp.
The yellow sodium floodlights were struggling to pierce the gloom and illuminate the car park. People hurried from one pool of light to the next.
Susie pulled her jacket collar closer and walked to her Golf. She slowed when she saw a figure unloading his shopping into the rear of a Toyota RAV4. He looked furtive but somehow familiar.
She'd seen him before, but it took a few seconds to place him.
She walked past, watching from the corner of her eye.
It was the man who'd been in the queue in front of her, the one whose card had been declined.
Susie did a quick double take to make sure.
He noticed, stopped what he was doing and met Susie's stare.
Something wrong? He continued to look at Susie, inviting an answer.
Susie was taken aback. She had him pegged as Mr. Law-abiding average citizen, not so much as a parking ticket, a family man, sent out to get the supplies for the holiday and too much pride to go home empty-handed. Yet here he was, taking the best part of 120 quid's worth of groceries without paying.
I'm saying nothing.
She was momentarily lost for words but checked left and right to make sure nobody was within earshot.
Can't say I blame you.
She stopped herself, ashamed she was condoning his actions, then added.
Happy Christmas.
Before walking hurriedly to her car and climbing in.
The switchboard answered after three rings.
Hello, police, can I help you?
It's Susan Jones, can you put me through to Commander Eddington?
Commander Eddington has left the office, he'll be back in on Wednesday.
The voice at the other end was firm but polite and efficient.
I have an ongoing situation, code Nevis, I need to get a message to him.
The reference to Code Nevis had an immediate effect on the switchboard operator, and the tone of voice was suddenly businesslike and serious.
"One moment, please."
There was silence. The moment lasted 30 seconds, then.
"Eddington here.
Sorry to bother you, sir, but I think we may have a problem. If you think it's worth disturbing me, then I have to assume you have good reason for doing so." Rob Eddington was never off duty, not really. Even on holiday, his phone was always by his side.
"You used the Nevis code, you're saying there's a situation in progress?"
"I think the data processing lines have been compromised. I don't know how widespread it is, but card payments are being declined."
"What makes you think the system hasn't crashed temporarily under pressure?"
Susie hesitated.
"I've got no evidence, just a gut feeling. If anyone wanted to do real damage, this would be the perfect time."
"I agree, but like I say, the system will be stretched to maximum capacity today. If it was going to fail, then you're right, now would be the worst possible time."
Eddington countered without much conviction.
"When did this happen?"
Susie checked her watch. It was just after 4.
"About half an hour ago."
There was silence while the commander of the cybercrime unit digested this.
3:30, just as the banks are shutting up shop for 4 days. Sounds like too much of a coincidence for my liking.
It may be nothing, it may come back online any minute, but I'm sure I've already seen one person walking out of a store without paying in the confusion.
He won't be the last.
Quite.
Eddington remarked. He considered Susie's report, his brain processing the wider implications.
"I'll need to get on to IT and see what they know.
Is there anything I can do in the meantime?"
Susie asked.
"Just cross your fingers and hope. We need more intel. Find out anything else you can. Call me again if anything changes."
He paused.
"If this goes on, your Christmas may not be how you planned it."
"No, sir, and nor will anyone else's."
The line went dead as Eddington hung up. Susie opened the car door and climbed out. Looking around, she could see trolleys being wheeled across the car park, a steady flow now. Some being pushed in as leisurely manner as it was possible, not wanting to attract attention, and others by shoppers almost jogging behind them, anxious to get to their cars and get away while they could. It was hard to tell which ones had a receipt for the goods they contained. Maybe the system had rectified itself and they were all innocent.
She had her doubts.
Susie walked back into the store. 10 minutes had passed since she left, and the situation had deteriorated noticeably. The security staff, one man in his late 20s with delusions of importance and power, dressed in black with a peaked cap and a utility belt, was doing his best to contain the growing unrest, trying and failing to stop desperate customers from bypassing the checkouts and heading for the car park. While his attention was taken up remonstrating with one angry shopper, 2 more would slip around behind him and escape into the darkness. Susie was astonished at how quickly the rule of law was breaking down. How long before the manager saw sense and closed the doors?
She called Nick again.
"Any news?"
"I was going to ask you the same thing."
He didn't sound quite as cheerful as the last time she called.
"Just been to put some fuel in the bike, had to pay cash."
"Shit.
What's happening with you?"
"Not looking good. People are simply walking out. They're not prepared to wait. There's nothing they can do. They're swamped."
She watched the security man wrestling the trolley from a woman half his size.
The woman started screaming as if she was being assaulted. While the easy target was being picked on, 3 others dashed out.
"Did you get hold of the big cheese?"
"Yeah.
He knew nothing about it.
He's getting on to the tech team to see what they know."
As she spoke, she saw the manager rush to support the security man. He brought 3 members of staff with him, and between them they closed 3 of the 4 outer doors, restricting the exit to a single narrow corridor and preventing anyone else from entering the store.
Nick could hear the commotion.
"What's going on?
What's all that shouting?"
"It's all getting out of hand,"
Susie said.
"They're trying to close the doors and prevent people leaving without paying.
Bloody hell, love, you'd better get out of there before you get caught up in it all."
"I know. But I've spent the last hour and a bit, longer actually, getting all our stuff for the next few days.
If I leave now, we'll be on bread and water for Christmas." Nick was unusually optimistic.
They'll get it sorted in the next few hours. It'll be business as normal tomorrow. You can go back then.
I'll come with you if you want.
I wish I shared your positive outlook.
There's no way I'm coming back. You can come on your own if you think there'll be anything here to buy.
So, what you going to do, turn outlaw?
I can't, can I?
She replied.
I am the law. I should be stopping those people stealing, but they'd take no notice of me.
Rubbish, you can be pretty fearsome when you're riled.
Susie considered it for a moment. She was torn.
I don't know, Nick. I'm not officially in the police. I just work for them.
I don't have proper ID or anything I could use.
Guess so.
Just get out, love. We'll manage one way or another. It's not worth getting involved, and there's not a hell of a lot you can do.
Leave the shopping and get back home.
I'll see you there.
Reluctantly, Susie agreed. She stuffed the phone back into her pocket and pushed the trolley towards the exit, more out of habit than any intention to steal the contents.
A message came over the loudspeakers. It was Jeannie, the checkout supervisor.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're sorry that we have been unable to restore our card payment system. We apologize for the inconvenience, but we've been advised that we have to close the store with immediate effect and must therefore ask all shoppers to make their way to the exit and leave their shopping behind. If there are any shoppers who are able to pay with cash, please make your way directly to checkout number 10. The effect of the announcement was instantaneous. Those who had waited patiently and, in some cases, impatiently, reacted. They had waited long enough, and their patience had expired.
Led by a vocal minority, shoppers stampeded towards the exit. They weren't going home empty-handed.
Even the mild-mannered, the upright, and the God-fearing were caught up in the rush.
The store staff were overwhelmed.
The security man gave up his futile attempt to be a one-man army, and after being rammed by a couple of heavily loaded trolleys aimed at him with some force, he gave up and scuttled out of the way.
The doors that had been closed had not been locked and were reopened by one man who pulled his trolley while his wife pushed it from behind.
Shoppers surged out into the car park and headed for their cars, barging each other angrily in an ultimate display of trolley rage.
Susie found herself swept along, meaning to push her trolley to one side and walk out without it.
Once clear of the bottleneck at the store exit, she slowed, unable to comprehend the scene, unable to believe how quickly it had happened, and unable to believe that she was as guilty as everyone else.
She could, of course, leave her shopping, get in the car and drive home.
Or she could do what everyone else was doing, load it into the boot and get the hell out of the place before anyone stopped her.
She continued towards her Golf, dodging a speeding pickup, full beam, hazards flashing, engine screaming.
The pedestrian traffic was soon outnumbered as cars reversed out of their spaces, horn sounded, tires squealed, and curses were exchanged as drivers indulged in games of chicken.
Who dares wins, Susie thought.
She could hear the scraping of metal and tinkle of glass at points around the car park where no one was prepared to play the chicken. She doubted they would be stopping to exchange names and addresses.
By the time she got to her car, there were few others around it.
She clicked the remote to unlock it and paused one last time.
As far as she was concerned, she hadn't committed any crime so far.
The moment she opened the tailgate and transferred her shopping to the car, she was a thief.
She looked around in the gloom. Who was watching? Who would know?
Her gaze lifted to the floodlights and the CCTV cameras mounted on them.
Real or fake?
Were they being monitored or were they just a deterrent?
Would they pick anything up in this light, in this fog?
She knew the answer. She opened the tailgate and almost threw the contents of the trolley into the back, slammed it shut and jumped into the car.
She took a deep breath, started the engine and navigated her way out.
There were still some people emerging from the store, some, Susie noticed, without trolleys.
Bless them, she thought.
She kept her distance from the store entrance and took the long way out of the car park.
The exit road joined the main drag out of the retail park where a steady stream of cars were queuing to get out.
It looked to Susie as if all the shops had suffered the same fate.
She breathed out and relaxed slightly. Surely, she was safe now.
This free sample has been created using AI.